Darko, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, TVA's Greg David has a conversation with Bren Haynes. Bren Haynes continues to foolishly pursue a career in television. He currently serves as president and executive producer of Picture Arcade, where he created the CBC series Crash Gallery. Brent made the leap to producing after spending 19 years as a broadcaster. Previously, he was a senior vice president of comedy and animation at MTV in New York for 5 years, where he managed a full development slate and oversaw production for close to 20 series, including World of Jenks, Nikki and Sarah Live, and Silent Library. Brent's MTV portfolio included scripted comedy animation, unscripted, and documentary. Before making the move to New York, Brent spent 11 years with the Comedy Network in Canada, where he helped launch the channel before ultimately becoming vice president of programming in charge of the development, acquisition, and scheduling teams. He was responsible for developing the smash hit Corner Gas and served as an executive on the show for 5 seasons. We'll hear about all of this and more in Greg's conversation with Bren Haynes.
Before we kind of get into some of your past work as a producer, I want to talk about your most current one, and that's Crash Gallery for CBC. Now, you're listed as the co-creator of Crash Gallery. So, Brent, kind of give me a background on how the show all came about in the first place.
I had just started working with Lark Productions in Vancouver after sort of launching my shingle. And, you know, they had had, a request from CBC, but CBC had reached out to say they wanted to find an art show, perhaps a competition style show for their arts stream.
Yeah.
And so, at first I thought, well, that's an arts competition show. That can't be done. So let's just not waste our time with it. But the more I thought about it and using sort of my MTV background, I thought, well, let's just take it as far as we can then. If we're going to have artists do stuff, let's put them in the most, you know, the extreme conditions that we can put them in based on the parameters we have. So, you know, I sat down to write this pitch and sort of the format idea. And I just started coming up with ideas of what we could do with artists. And I played that back to Lark and they fit into that. And, together we worked on what that would be and sent it to the CBC, and they said, yeah, let's do it. So, I think we were a little shocked because, you know, we had pushed as far as we thought we could, or farther than we thought we could go, frankly, for the CBC, and they embraced it right away. So that was exciting.
So when you were kind of brainstorming what the ideas, some of the possible ideas were, what do you remember what some of those other ideas were before it became the format that it is now?
Well, it's very similar to what it was in its inception. I think, you know, what we, you know, given all the money in the world, we wanted to do more extreme things with the artist, to be honest. That's kind of where the difference is from then till now. And I would say, you know, in this current season, we're getting closer to that than we were last year. But I think, you know, right from the get-go, the only differences are that, you know, we maybe had more artists or more challenges, or just trying to figure out the format was probably the biggest changes. But I think at its heart, what it is what we wanted to do from the beginning.
What I liked about the show from the very beginning is the challenge to have these artists work outside of their comfort zone. You know, they're working with mediums that they haven't worked with before. You know, some of these folks are used to doing sculpture, and now all of a sudden they're having to work in oils or vice versa. And I love the fact that, you know, they have to do it within a time limit. You know, artists can be very, you know, precious about their work, just as writers can be. You know, you spend so much time writing and perfecting something, but in a show like Crash Gallery, there's none of that. It's like you hit the ground running, and you're doing it in front of a live audience that are eating snacks and drinking adult beverages. So you've got a potentially rowdy crowd as well. So I really like that that aspect of it, and obviously that's been working for you guys too.
Yeah, you know, the thing we wanted to do is see how far we could push the artists, as I was saying. And, you know, this year, what we did to make that even stronger is, you know, they're still way out of their comfort zone, but we gave them something more in their wheelhouse. So it's not like, you know, if they're painters, they're painting, but it's not like it's still outside their comfort zone and thing you will like. But we wanted to do is push, you know, these challenges to the extreme. So that's part of the fun. And what we, really wanted to do with the show, I think, to connect with the audience, because it is arts, and and the idea that, you know, people don't go to museums or art galleries because it feels like they're out of their depth, or it's too hoity-toity, or what we want to do is make this play along at home. So we wanted you to feel like, well, if you were doing it, what would you do? Even if you're not an artist, we wanted you to feel like, if you were there, how would you tackle this challenge? Because in the end, that's what it is. It's a challenge, and it's like, it's not like any other challenge show, but the idea of like, how would I respond in this moment is a very big part of the show.
Well, and the other thing about it is, as a viewer, it's, you know, as it is with art, everybody has an opinion about whether they like something. So not only can you sit on the couch and say, well, here's what I would have done, you can also say, oh, I really don't like what they're doing right now. So it's very interactive, you know, whether it's the people in the studio or sitting at home. You guys have made art very accessible to people sitting in their basements.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. And our host, Sean, has been a big part of that. And even, you know, when we're doing the show, we disagree, the people, you know, the producers and Sean and everybody disagrees on which piece should win the round, or which person should be the champion, which is great because we all like what we like, and that's the point.
Can you talk a little bit about CBC's art stream? I mean, they've been very ambitious this past season with shows like Crash Gallery, with Exhibitionists. They've also had a lot of digital series surrounding art as well. This is clearly a direction that CBC is going in. And, you know, obviously, maybe you're a little bit biased because you've got a show in that stream. But, you know, they're definitely reaching out to a new audience with their arts programming. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, for sure. I think, you know, they're looking to get to an audience that's maybe younger than they traditionally had for this kind of programming. And again, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. This is all about making it accessible, making art accessible, making, you know, this world accessible to a different audience, as opposed to, you know, maybe what, you know, CBC would have done 20 years ago, which has been a little more high-minded about it. And not that these aren't good shows that focus on good art, but the goal here, and at least it's been expressed to us, is to, you know, broaden that appeal and reach a different group than maybe they had in the past.
When it comes to art, where do you stand, Brent? Are you a fan of art? Do you like to go to galleries and stuff like that?
You know, I have and I do. I don't claim to be an art aficionado, but I certainly, you know, I would say, as I've traveled around the world, I've definitely gone to the art galleries as a point, not just because of touristing. So there are moments in my past where, you know, I've been at the Chicago Art Gallery or the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, where, you know, I've gone to see specific things. So again, my art knowledge would not compete with anyone's in the real world, but I know what I like, and I do, you know, I do like going to the museums and the art galleries for sure.
You already mentioned Sean, so let's talk a little bit about Sean O'Neill. He's been fantastic as the host. He's the Associate Director of Adult Programming and Partnerships at the Art Gallery of Ontario. So how did you end up landing him? Were you doing, did you cast far and wide to find somebody to host the show? And why did you feel you needed to have a host?
Well, I think, let me answer the second question first, which is, you know, we need to have a host because we needed to bridge that gap in the art world. We needed somebody who could say, oh, this is going to be, this is for you. This is, you know, how are we going to relate what they're doing to the art world in general, and then also target it to the people at home? There were really those three pins that we had to deal with. And as far as searching for someone, we did put out a pretty wide casting call. We saw a lot of people from, you know, comedians to musicians to artists to whoever, actors, anybody who had a connection to the art world is kind of what we were going for. And then I believe it came through Heather Conway at the CBC, down through our production exec, Grishna Krupa, to talk to Sean O'Neill at the Art Gallery of Ontario, because he may know someone. Mm. And then in talking to Sean, we were like, hey, you sound pretty great. So we got him on tape, and we got him on video, and he was fantastic from the get-go. And turns out Sean had a past in television. He'd been on TV shows before as a kid, so he kind of knew how it all worked, and that really helped. And he, from day one, has been extraordinary. He, you know, he comes in, he works with us. You know, this year he worked with us on finding experts to help judge the art.
He
comes in and works with me on the scripts. He knows more about art than I do, which is, hopefully he knows a lot about art. So it was lucky that we tripped across him, and we owe CBC thanks for finding him, because he's been terrific.
Again, it's all about accessibility. I mean, he's a young, hip guy working at the AGO. The AGO has, at this time that we're recording, it's the beginning of August. So the Steve Martin, the Group of Seven show has just started. But I mean, the AGO has been bringing in these great shows, and they've got these free nights on Wednesdays for people to go in. So it's really taking art, like Crash Gallery does, taking art and bringing it down to attracting younger people and saying, hey, listen, art isn't a stodgy thing that you should be afraid of. Come on in and check this stuff out.
Yeah, and that's been Sean's job, which has been why he's been so amazingly helpful on the show, because he gets that. And then that's all I can say. He gets it. It's huge.
Yeah. So let's talk about season two. You've mentioned it a couple of times already. You guys have just finished wrapping production on season two. Is that right?
That's right.
So what were some of the changes that you've made to the show? Was there anything that you've made changes to for season two that you said, we need to tweak things a little bit? It sounds like you did, because you've already referenced the challenges changing a bit.
Yeah, there are two things that we did, I think. We wanted to up the level of difficulty, so to speak, and we also wanted to up the level of artistry, and therefore we required even stronger artists. Not that season ones weren't great, but what we wanted to do, and then there's one other sort of format change, but what we wanted to do, as I said, is we put artists more in their skill set, as opposed to pushing them. We didn't ask artists to, painters to sculpt this year, which I know you like, but, but what we did is when we made them paint, we made it more difficult for them. So, we did everything from, have them hang upside down, to have them destroy their work halfway through and have to rebuild it, to we had, one challenge where they're literally painting underwater. and the work is incredible. Like if you looked at it and said to someone, "Oh, this was created in 30 minutes," it would blow your mind. And then if you said, "Oh, and they also had to do it well underwater,"
right?
I don't, your mind just. We were shocked by the level of it all. So that was a huge thing. And the second thing we did was, last year we had experts chime in that were just sort of roaming through the gallery. This year we have three specific experts who are there. They're kind of like in the judges role, but they're not judges. They help decide who goes on to the second round, but the audience still votes for the last round. So we just wanted to give more context and more expertise to the process, just to sort of let people at home in more on what's going on and why things are, looking the way they are, or why something's good versus why it's not quite there.
Are you, and you'll be naming those experts, I guess you're going to be waiting until closer to the season two premiere to announce those people, those experts?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not getting a scoop today. It's fine. Today. It's fine. It's fine.
I'm wondering, can I give you the scoop? I don't know where we are with that. I should probably check with someone before I say anything.
That's fine. I don't want to get you into any trouble. That's fine. Now, when it's... What's been the reaction from the arts community? Obviously the production is done out in Vancouver, and I'm assuming you stayed in Vancouver for season two. What's been the feedback like from the arts community out there?
It's quite amazing, because we were worried going into it that people were going to think we're, making fun of the art world or bastardizing the art world. But I would say, like, from, in season one, we had... we were tracking down applicants for the show. We had to go after people to see if they would do it. And people were hesitant, and they were like, "I don't know." And people backed out before we even went to air, like, who were in. And then this season we had over 2,000 applicants for the show. And this is for, we do five episodes. There's three, the 15 artists is all we need for the whole run of the series. So we had 2,000 people apply, and eagerly apply, which is amazing. And then on top of that, you know, when they come in and we speak to them for the first time, they're really rooting to get the most difficult, weirdest challenge. We're always worried, like, I don't know, we have to check to see if these people want to go underwater. Mm-hmm. And then when they come in, they're like, oh, I wanted the underwater one. And you're like, okay. So I think there's something about the artist's psyche that's like, you know, push me to the wall. I want to find out what I can do when I get there.
Those 2,000 or over 2,000 applicants that you had, were they from all the way from across Canada? Like, did you have people coming in from Ontario and the East Coast to compete?
Yeah, we have people from all over the country this season. So right from east to west, we're covered. But yeah, we went Canada-wide.
I do have to say that we had several people contact us here at the TVA website and wanted to know how to audition. So we were happy to pass along that audition news. So I'll be cheering for those people.
Yeah. Hey, go TVA people.
When you're doing, you mentioned it a couple of times now, this underwater challenge. What are some of the challenges as a producer in putting together a challenge like that? I guess number one would be that the artists don't drown. But what are some of the other challenges?
They're endless. You know, we test everything to find out if it'll work. I mean, my first reaction was, well, how do you paint underwater? How does the paint work? Until someone explained that oil and water don't mix, and it's totally fine. But I, you know what? Even when I was watching it happen, I didn't believe it. Watching oil go onto a canvas while underwater, and then when they raised the paintings out of the water, I thought, oh, it's just going to drip everywhere, and it didn't. Science boggles my mind. So
okay.
There's that. I mean, there's some safety concerns this year, by pushing it, you know, whether people can actually handle hanging upside down for 30 minutes. There's technological issues. We did try to do some things with digital walls. So a lot of it just comes down to testing and testing and testing. I mean, what we kind of create these things, in a vacuum, and, fortunate for us, we have people on staff that are artists. Mm-hmm. We had Michael Markowski, who was in one of the episodes last year, was a consultant on the show this year, and he helped develop some of the challenges and test them to make sure that when the artists got into the rigs or however they were, that these would actually work. So the physicality is one of the biggest challenges of making this show. Like, can we really do this to a person?
It's funny, you know, at first blush, you would think, okay, well, it's Brent Haynes and an art show, and they don't necessarily fit together. But then now that you're talking about this, this is sounding more like harkening back to your MTV days. So I guess it's not too far away from your past, is it?
No, you know, I've always looked at this, you know, CBC made it like this, but I've always looked at it from the perspective of, as a comedy show. Or a comedy game show or stuff I've done in my past. It's the only way I can do it because that's what I do. So for me, it was, you know, I trusted the people around me about creating art, but I really wanted to figure out how to do a show that was super entertaining and fun. And, you know, it's informative and we want it to be somewhat informative, but really, I mean, it's TV. So it needs to be exciting.
And then one last question before we take a short break, and that's just about the logistics of filming in Vancouver. I think you guys filmed in the same gallery in season one. Like, you stayed put, and production was a week long. Is that right?
Yeah. So we shoot for – we had a different gallery this season, but okay. We shoot an episode a day.
And how does that work production wise? Is that a pretty long day for everybody involved? How does that kind of shake out?
It's a pretty long day. You know, it's a good 10-hour day, probably longer if you talk to our line producer. But you know, there's a lot of it works. You know, there's a lot of rigging because even though there's only two challenges an episode, we have to stop down for a while,
right?
To, you know, set up the second challenge, and now everything's bigger this year. It kind of pushed us to the edges of our day, but you know, it's weirdly all worth it for the half hour that the challenges are happening, because they're exciting and the audience gets right into it, and they cheer. Who cheers artists? But they cheer and they have a good time. So you know, that's the show right there.
Now, how much does the free food and the free alcohol have to do with the cheering?
You know, it's not a lot of free food. It's not a lot of free alcohol.
Okay.
This year they weren't drinking. So they still stuck with us.
So speaking of drinking, let's take a little bit of a break. One of the things that that we do when Anthony and Diane and I record our other podcast for TVA, where we kind of cover the latest news in the Canadian TV industry, what's coming up production-wise, is we record it at night for Anthony and I, because I'm in Toronto and he's in Hamilton and Diane is out in Vancouver. So it's 7 o'clock her time, 10 o'clock our time, and we're usually enjoying an adult beverage. Now, it is just after 1 o'clock my time here in the Eastern time zone, and just after 10 in Vancouver for you. So I'm not drinking anything alcoholic.
I am.
Right now. Oh, you are? Okay. Okay. So I'm boring, because it's so hot here in Toronto. I'm just drinking water through the lovely Brita filter. But if this was nighttime, I would either be drinking a hard cider, which I've really gotten into this summer, or maybe a spiked root beer. There are several.
Root beer. What are you spiking the root beer with?
It's vodka.
Vodka in root beer.
Yeah.
Any sense to me?
Well, it's there's several breweries here in Toronto that are making them, and so I tried one brand. I forget what it's called, Uncle Something. I should have done some research before we started recording, but it's only 5% alcohol. But I mean, it's nice and refreshing on a summer day. So that's what I would be drinking if we were recording at night. But instead, I'm drinking the water. Now, you did say, even though it's 20 after 10 your time, you're already into the alcohol?
Yeah, I'm not drinking. You know, if it were evening, you know, I'm a cocktail and wine guy. I like to start with a cocktail and then move into wine. That's my that's how I like to go. I have my latest thing has been Boulevard J's.
Oh,
which are basically Negronis but with bourbon instead of gin. So that's been sort of my cocktail of the summer. Although I have a margarita problem, and I'll tell you what it is. If someone says margarita or orders a margarita, I have to have a margarita. I can't, there's no, like, as soon as I hear it, I just, that's my refreshing, I was gonna say afternoon drink, but that's inappropriate, but that's my sort of early evening, if it's warm out, margarita I just have an issue. So if someone says it, I'm having one.
So how far back does this issue go? Is this something from college days when you were down in Mexico or something?
I know it's fairly recent, actually.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think it started more, you know, after living in New York, such a cocktail town.
Yeah.
And, you know, for like 6 years I was in New York, but flying to LA regularly. And I don't know, I think it came out of LA just because it would be so hot there in the summers. And then when I'm in LA, I tend to eat either sushi or Mexican food. And if I'm having Mexican, then I'm having a margarita. So I think that's the origins of it. So now I have such a strong taste for them that if someone says it, it's what I want. It has to be a good one, though. I don't want like a bar mix sour. It has to be like the real deal.
Right. Okay. Not a powder, you know, bag and mixed with water and then that type of thing.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Now you mentioned Mexican. Now I want tacos.
Well, is there a good taco place near you?
No. Well, so I'm out of luck.
You know, in my household, I have a 6-year-old, and we do Taco Tuesdays.
Based on I the should Lego do that.
We have tacos every Tuesday.
All right. Okay. Yeah, I guess it doesn't help also that it's 20 after 1 and I haven't had any lunch, and maybe that's why I'm craving tacos. So let's get back into your career, and I want to go back a little bit, because the first time that I saw your name attached to anything, it was when you were at CTV through things like Punched Up, Corner Gas, and Robson Arms. So how did you end up getting into the industry in the first place, Brent? Did you go to school for it? How did that work?
Yeah, you know, I went to Humber College for their film and television program. And then I left early to go to, I was a bit of a wanderer. So I went off to university and did theater and English lit and I don't know, just sort of wanted to figure out, you know, I thought I wanted to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of left the sort of film and TV program because it was more about being a producer mostly, it seemed. I mean, although there were other avenues and, you know, I think I was... I was pretty good at the producing thing, but I was in kind of in denial. I wanted to write. So I went off to do that. And I came out thinking I was going to be a writer, but I was always drawn back into the production side. Mm-hmm. And then CBC way back when had this thing called a job shop.
Okay.
Where you go in and look for jobs.
Wow.
I know they had a posting board, and most of it was, you know, was going to people internally, but they had to post it because of, you know, government rules and union rules, I believe. So I went in and I would apply and I would apply and I would apply. I'd go down once a week. And I got a call once and they called me in for an interview, and I didn't get the job, but then I got a call from whoever interviewed me recommending me for another job as an assistant in the arts and comedy department. And mm-hmm. And I got that gig as an assistant to Ed Robinson.
Wow. Man, if you're going to be an assistant to anybody, Ed's a great guy to be following around.
Yeah, Ed was, you know, pretty terrific all the way through. I mean, he's responsible for most of my career, so I owe that man a huge debt.
It's interesting, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to be a writer, but the production, you were kind of drawn to the production side of things. So what is it that's different in a brain, a producer brain, as opposed to a writer's brain?
I don't know. I mean, I work a lot with writers, obviously, and I really love that part. And I'm glad that, you know, I went down the writing path because it's allowed me to sort of be able to, I feel, work really well with writers and understand them.
Sure.
I think the producer side of the brain, or at least, you know, and I was, you know, a network executive, which is sort of being the flip side of being a producer for a long time, is the sort of the making, taking the chaos and making it into something, you know, that it's almost like just a little bit of like OCD of like, we have to make this fit this thing and be perfect and get it from here to there.
Yeah.
And I really like that part. I like orchestrating the dance, you know, playing the chess game of creative production, negotiations, talent management, all of that appeals to me. And I think, you know, as a writer, you're stuck in solitude and you're deep in the muck and you're crafting this beautiful thing. I want to take the beautiful thing and then do something with it. I think the reasons I wanted to write was so I could have something to take and do all these things with.
Okay.
That makes sense. That was kind of a rambler, but.
Okay. And then, you know, as a network executive, working with these creative people, I mean, obviously, you know, you're giving things like network notes, but you're also there as a support system. I think some people think of network notes as a dirty thing and a bad thing and something that isn't needed. Talk to me about the importance of having network notes and why networks need to be, you know, giving input to their showrunners and to their writers that are working on the staffs of these shows.
You know, I think the thing about being a network exec is, I mean, the good ones are guides. You know, you're trying to keep something, you know, on the rails. You're not trying to change it. You're not trying to build it into an image of something that you want it to be. And I think sometimes that happens, but, the goal is just to guide the creative, to guide the writers and the producers to a place where this is the show we want because it fits these guardrails of what we're doing. And, you know, when you work at a network, you're all competing against each other. So you try to find your niche. You try to find the thing that brings audiences to you. Mm-hmm. So your job is to take this creative thing, whether it's an unscripted or scripted show, and, you know, keep it between the lines of what you're trying to create. And presumably you're buying shows that fit that path anyway.
Right.
So that's the goal of the network exec, is to give notes that keep it on track and not to give notes that change it or take it into weird directions or somehow flip it on its head. You know, if you're going to do that happens early. But the idea is the importance of network notes, which I think you're right. They do get maligned. And you know, the reason why they get maligned is sometimes they are crazy. But, you know, the real goal is to make sure everybody's making the same show and making it for the same network. You know, I have often said that, you know, and I've often been in a position where I've read great scripts and heard great ideas, but thought this is not going to work on my network. So, you know, you have to pass and you have to move on. But
right. But
the ones you do, you don't want them going off into a direction that no longer you're kind of rooting for them to get picked up, if you know
right.
what I mean, to make it and for audiences to watch it. So your job is to make that happen.
So let's kind of jump to you leaving Canada and going to the US. You went to MTV. And you were senior vice president of comedy and animation. Is that right?
That's right.
And so you're responsible for shows like College Life, Nitro Circus, and Buzzin', right?
I didn't do Nitro Circus.
Okay.
That's been attributed to me, but I don't know why. it's probably on an IMDb page somewhere, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Buzzin' was something I jumped into when I got there. College Life was something, that I was like one of the first pickups I did. Silent Library was one of the shows I did. World of Jinx, which was a documentary series, had nothing to do with comedy animation, although it started out funny and then it turned poignant, but that's, something we had room to do. And I think the last show I worked on before that I was actually a producer on was Nikki and Sarah Live.
Okay. So then, obviously comparing the Canadian television industry to the U.S. industry is like trying to compare apples to oranges, literally. But what were your impressions going down to New York City and working for MTV? What was kind of the biggest thing, the biggest change, and the biggest kind of learning curve for you going down there and working for that company?
I think it was scale, really.
Yeah.
Was the biggest thing, making a show is making a show. But there's great things about the Canadian business and great things about the American business, and they're not the same things. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there is an intensity in the U.S. business that it's like the business is really business. It really is. What have you done for me lately? In a good way. You're constantly asked to deliver. You're constantly trying to find the next show. You're turning things over. Where the Canadian system is slower, and it allows you to spend more time in development and more time considering what you want to do with shows and what will work. The happy medium to me is like somewhere in between. But yeah, that was the difference. Especially with MTV, it's a very different kind of network. The audience, you get two seasons basically before the audience grows out of the show. So you're really feeding the beast on that channel. We had to do, I think we were making 15 pilots a year and overseeing 5 shows in production. And I had like a small team. So, it was nonstop, which is great. That was the fun part about it, was we were always making TV shows.
And the reason was the reason that you left. I mean, you could have obviously probably stayed with CTV for as long as you wanted. What was the reason for heading down to the U.S.? Just looking to expand yourself and learn new things?
Yeah, it was an opportunity to grow, as they say, but sure, also stay really tied to development. I think the opportunities for me to grow in Canada, although exceptional, and they were certainly there, it was a really tough decision. Mm-hmm. But we're more corporate. And I had to make a decision at the time if I wanted to grow into, running and being the general manager of a channel versus development, which is my favorite thing. And I think faced the opportunity to do more development at a more senior level and, do it in a different, try something new in a different place, in a different country. I mean, all of that appealed to me at the time.
And then, we come to back kind of full circle. You're back in Canada, but also working out of LA as well. But you've got your own production company, which is Picture Arcade. So why come back to Canada and why start up your own production company? I guess I can guess, but I'll let you tell me.
I want to hear what you want to guess. I think that's just another opportunity. I think, at the end of the day, I had done the broadcasting thing and I would never say never to go back to it, but I just wanted to again try something new. And over time at MTV, the interesting thing about MTV was we had our own little development department, but we really acted like our own mini production company. Mm-hmm. Because again, there were many departments and so much had to be done and we had to make a lot of our own decisions. And so we ended up being EPs on our own show because we would just come up with ideas and someone would greenlight it, and away we went. And we would hire producers, but we'd also have to be responsible for that show and the way a producer was. And I think that bug kind of bit me a little bit, and so I started to produce more while I was at MTV. And then when I decided that MTV, that journey was over, I was talking to Louise Clark, and she had said, "Well, why don't you come? If you want to produce, why don't you come do do it out of Vancouver because we have our ties to NBC, and you can work in LA and, you know, stay in that system and be a part of this system, and you know people here. And it all just kind of made sense. I have, you know, I have a foot in both countries, so why not use it?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you're, you know, just thinking while you're talking about this, you know, Julie Bristow used to be a network executive at CBC and left to start up her own production company. Amy Cameron left, I think she was at CBC as well, and left to team up with her sister Tassie for their own production company. So it seems as though that's kind of the natural, organic way for a network executive to move, is to start up your own production company.
I think it's something we all talk about. I mean, it's certainly something we all talk about. It's something we think about. You know, it's not easy, but when the opportunity presents itself, you know, you kind of want to be master of your own fate a little bit at times after years of, you know, working for a network. And I've had, you know, wonderful experiences, so I can't knock it. It's not like it was bad.
Sure.
But at some point you're like, well, I want to make a decision. I want to work on, you know, you, when you work for network, you're in their guardrail. So at MTV, we're making shows for teen to 20 something women was all we were making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, and Comedy Network and CTV, I was making comedy. And here now it's like, well, I can make any of those. Like, and I can make a drama, I can make a sci-fi, I can do anything I want. So it just kind of allows you to expand, I think, and give it a shot. And I mean, I know the roads are littered with network execs who've tried to be producers, but even, you know, even in the long run, if it doesn't lay out, it's something I wanted to try. And, you know, it's certainly been a roller coaster ride and very exciting.
So what can you say about, like, Crash Gallery is you've got this first look deal with Lark Productions, and Crash Gallery is part of that deal. Anything else in the works with Lark that you can talk about at this point?
Well, I'm, you know, I've been working off and on over the years with Dave Thomas of SCTV fame.
Yeah.
You know, it started at CTV and we developed a show with him. And then when I went to MTV, he had his own animation company and I needed an animated show quickly.
Yeah.
For a reel I was doing, and he did it. He did this funny little thing, this funny little show called Popzilla, and it got picked up to series. So we did that together. And so since I've sort of come back into this world, I've teamed up with Dave on a couple of things, and we've been in development already with a network on one script. Unfortunately, it's not going, but we have something else we're going to take out in the fall together. So that's probably, you know, one of the biggest things I'm working on. I've been, you know, been working with some of them, you know, my old corner. I've been working with Paul Mather, who was, you know, showrunner in Corner Gas.
Yep.
A little small skin of the prairie. So, you know, he's down in LA. So I've been, you know, kind of going back to the people, circling back to the people I've been working with over my career and seeing how we can team up. So that's been, you know, those are a couple of the projects that are in the works right now, but there's some comedy formats I'm working on and some other things that are going to take out in the fall and early next year.
And does it excite you to have the possibility of a sci-fi show, to have a drama show? I mean, like you've already said, when you own your own production company, the sky is really the limit. I mean, you've got your art reality show now, so now it's moving on to whatever genre, right?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, comedy's always been my thing, and
sure.
I've almost intentionally not dwelled on it while I've done a couple of things with some people while I've been doing this, but I haven't spent, you know, focused my energy on it. And, you know, there was a brief moment in time where I was overseeing both the Comedy Network and Space before I left for New York. So sci-fi is something I've always, I've just always been a nerd that way. And, you know, the old sort of PI shows like Moonlighting, Remington Steele, and the sort of fun, I guess, those, you know, procedural 1 hour dramas that were, you know, in the 70s and 80s, I've always loved. And so I love to get into sci-fi or do something that's more of a mystery series.
You know, sci-fi is so hot right now. You've got Orphan Black, Winona Earp, Killjoys, Dark Matter. And then, you know, you mentioned Moonlighting, and that's kind of like Jason Priestley's new series, Private Eyes on Global, that just finished its first season. So,
right.
You know, this genre stuff is just so hot right now, especially in the sci-fi world.
Yeah, I think sci-fi is, you know, a real opportunity for Canadian producers because, you know, I mean, you know, it lived in the U.S. and having worked there, you know, I know how those minds work. And, you know, if they feel like Canadians can do this genre, then they're going to look to Canadians to do this genre. And there's an opening right now, absolutely, for for that. And the fact that sci-fi can play on any network, it's not just for a science fiction network, and anybody will get into that, to that genre. And it's fun, and you know, it reaches wide audiences. So it is really, you know, probably the best genre to be in.
Talk a little bit about your company and accepting pitches. Do you accept outside pitches from people, or are you mainly working with other people and working on pitches internally for programming?
I do take pitches. My process is, sure, I'll look at whatever anybody sends me.
Right.
But that's always been my process. That's sure. Not just speaking. That sounds desperate, but I mean, you know. But for me, it's like, I'll take a look at something. I mean, my process, it has to fit what I want to do, because otherwise it won't work. I mean, that as a, you know, broadcaster, you have to sort of love what you're making. So it has to fit my sort of taste level. But I mean, I love working with writers. I love working with idea makers. So yeah, I am taking pitches, and you know, Lark sends me stuff that they get. And a lot of my time, to be honest, is calling up writers that either I know or that I want to work with and saying, hey, can we talk about something? And then, maybe something sparks in the meeting. Maybe something sparks down the road, but I'm actively talking to writers all the time, and meeting with them and, hopefully finding something that jazzes us both.
Okay. So, two more questions before we wrap up. And, the first one is, this is something that we ask of everybody that participates in the TV ABCs podcast. And that's about your childhood and watching television as a kid and the types of shows that kind of informed you. For me, it was the 80s. So while I started with like the Polka Dot Door and Sesame Street and Mr. Dressup and Friendly Giant, but then I was an 80s kid with the A-Team and Magnum P.I. and the Incredible Hulk and stuff like that. What about you? What were the shows that you remember distinctly watching when you were a kid growing up?
You know, my childhood is littered with like 70s sitcoms.
Sure.
Bob Newhart Show was huge. Taxi, WKRP, Mark and Mindy. Those were like just my family sit down and watch those sitcoms, and that was our thing. I mean, the first show I can remember watching was The $6 Million Man.
Oh, yeah.
That was like the biggest deal to me to be able to stay up for that. That was huge. And I think I started morphing into, like, when I discovered SCTV, that's when my life changed, really, because I was like, this show is for me. They're talking about stuff that I, you know, this is funny and it's relevant. And so that was sort of the big, I think the big turning point. But I mean, that NBC Thursday Night lineup of the 80s was hugely influential. Cheers was a show that I was just like, from day one, like, this is it. This is the thing. I just, love the comedy of it. And then when Letterman came along, it was also like, oh, you can do anything on TV. That's cool.
Right. Well, it's so funny you mentioned SCTV. So it must be really kind of surreal to be working with Dave Thomas then.
It is a little bit. It's working closely with Dave, and he loves to tell me, I should say, I ask him, I love to ask him, and then he loves to tell the stories of SCTV, and I'm still a little kid inside when he's talking about, some of these characters and stuff. So it's been a really, really fun to work with Dave and get to know him.
So last question, now that you've worked in Canada, you worked in the States, and now you're back in Canada working in this industry, what are your thoughts on the state of the Canadian television industry? We have some, fantastic programming that's on the air now and some other stuff that looks really good that's on the way. But do you think it's the state that it's healthy here in Canada?
Man, that is a heavy question for the last question.
Yeah.
That's not what you're drinking. That's a... Do I think it's how? I think it's, I think it's on the upswing. If that, I don't want to walk the fence here, but I think, there's a lot of good people since I've come back, and everything, things have changed in the 6 years I was gone. And, there's a lot of creative, good people here. And I think, there's troubles in the US market. There's troubles in this market. I think it's because it's turning into a global market. I see everybody trying to get their footing and what that means and what travels best and where they can, it's no longer about selling shows in Canada. It's like selling shows to the world. And my feeling is when I came back, it felt unhealthy. It felt like the market was in turmoil, which I think a lot of people would agree with, but it looks like people are trying to find their footing. I think we're still in the middle of the seismic shift. So it's hard to say, but you know, one of the reasons I did this because this is Lark is an international company, and so it was the idea of working on a global scale, which is, I think, the way to go, because I don't think, you know, shows on their own sustain themselves in one culture anymore.
Well, thanks to Brent Haynes for sitting down to speak with Greg David for this episode of TV ABCs. And this is what we do every couple of weeks, folks. You have the regular TVA podcast 1 week talking about the news and everything that's upcoming and things that are going on in Canadian television. And then every other week, we have a talk with some of the more creative people behind the shows that you love, sometimes in front of the camera, sometimes behind the camera, but someone on the team of putting together some of the great Canadian television that we have. You can get in touch with us, and you can listen to all of the past episodes if you want to by going to tv-eh.com, clicking on the podcast tab at the top. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/TV_EH. If you go there and you'd like to give us $1 a month, $1 a show, $5 a month, $20 a show, let your mind run wild. We would appreciate any support you would give us. But as always, you can always listen to this podcast for free. And if the only support you can give us is sharing it with your friends, we would appreciate that you do that too. You can get in touch with Greg on Twitter at Greg_David. You can get in touch with me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. TVA is also on Twitter at TV_EH. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. Hope you listen to us next week. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.